Nigel Watson, our guest, will be taking your calls during the next hour. His book, UFOs of the First World War, will be out on May 1st. We have links to that and to the information from our first guest this evening, Bill Burns. Just go check it out at coasttocoastam.com. I've got a quick question for you before we go to the next break, Nigel. With all of the accounts that you were able to collect for this book, which of the accounts did you feel was the most credible that it may have actually been an alien craft that was sighted?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think one of the most credible and quite interesting ones was a one of aircraft were sent up to go after an aircraft that was seen to be heading towards London, and they went up, and four separate aircraft saw this object in the sky, and one of them actually took a pot shot at it with his revolver. So, you know, that shows that it wasn't just something, you know, like Venus and Mars. You know, the pilot obviously thought it was something close to them. It was at a time when there was an actual German Zeppelin raid of London, but these other four aircraft that went to intercept this particular object encountered something that wasn't anything to do with that particular raid. So I think that was that's one of the most interesting accounts. And, you know, one that's least explainable, because, you know, like I say, a lot of these accounts are of just distant lights, really, so it's hard to really pin down anything about them, whereas with this, it's slightly more tangible. And like one of the pilots, Lieutenant Maxwell, he said he distinctly saw an artificial light to the north of him, about the same height as him. He followed the light northeast for nearly 20 minutes, and it seemed to go slightly higher and quicker than his aircraft until he lost it in the clouds. So that sounds like it was a moving object of some sort, rather than just a stationary star, and also it was going slightly faster than him, which indicates it wasn't a balloon or an airship, really, because he would have easily caught up with an airship. And then another pilot, he also spotted the light over London. He lost sight of that in clouds as well. Another pilot who saw it said it looked like a row of lighted windows, which looked like a railway carriage with blinds drawn. And that particular pilot, Lieutenant Morgan, took out his Beverly Scott service revolver and fired several shots at it. And then in response to that, the lights rose rapidly, and but went up so fast that it seemed like his aircraft seemed to be diving, you know, in comparison. And he lost his bearings and he had to make a crash landing in some marshes after that. So, that sounds like quite an interesting encounter, really. But when they sent in their report, one of the commanders said, "Oh, night flying must be difficult and dangerous and require considerable nerve and pluck, but this airman seems to have been gifted with more than usually vivid imagination." So I suppose we're skeptics even then, ready to criticize them and not back any sightings.
Let's take a quick break. Nigel Watson, our guest, will come back. We'll take your phone calls. Also, CIA here in the United States is now taking credit for many of the UFO sightings during the 40s and 50s. Is there any release from the government in Europe stating that they were, in fact, in charge of those craft at those times? Is there anything similar to what we've had disclosed to us here in the United States? We'll find out from our guest right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Our guest for the evening, Nigel Watson. We've got some calls coming in, but I wanted to ask you, Nigel, with the disclosure here in the United States, CIA taking responsibility for many of the quote-unquote craft that was seen in the 40s and 50s, has there ever been any disclosure in Europe where one of the governments has come forward to say that those things that were seen during the World War II or even possibly earlier were in fact German engineering or anything like that, so they would actually take some ownership of this?
All right. I think that's interesting in the context of ghost rockets seen towards the end of the Second World War and into the peacetime years, where these ghost rockets were seen mainly over the Scandinavian countries and often were seen to crash into lakes. So some of them, the thought, were German secret weapons, like the V-2, that being captured by the Russians and were being experimented with. But they're just like UFOs, really. They're very elusive, and I think perhaps one or two cases might have been of actual V-2 rockets, but I think the others are, might have been misinterpretations of meteors or things like that. But often there were some very clear sightings of people seeing things plunge into lakes, getting out of any solid evidence has been quite elusive. But those sort of cases triggered an interest throughout Europe into what these objects were, before the term flying saucers. I think with the OCIA thing, it's rather ironic, really, that they spent the whole of the 50s and 60s trying to suppress and deny UFO sightings, and then a few decades later say they were responsible for them. So in a way, they're having the cake and eat it. I think in Britain, the main policy is just to say that that we don't officially investigate UFO sightings, and that they're of no defence implication, really. So they kind of wash their hands of UFOs by saying they don't know what they were, but would just say they don't think they're sufficiently interesting to pose any threat to us. But the British government did conduct quite a few different secret investigations. Obviously they weren't as extensive as the studies in America, mm-hmm. but often they, one Project Condigan concluded that there could be some exotic rare phenomena like plasma phenomenon that might cause electrical interference and radar returns. So even then, the thought there might be something happening that isn't just explainable by the usual subjects like suspects like Venus and Mars and planets or balloons or whatever. But then we go on to say, even if that's the case, they're not particularly, it doesn't pose a threat to the national defence of Britain. So we kind of use that as an excuse not to bother to conduct investigations. But I suspect if it was something really important did happen, I think any government would have to investigate, really, whether they believed in UFOs or not.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the problem, which also occurred in the First World War, is that you get too many people reporting strange lights in the sky, and then you can't tell the signal from the noise. And I think that's a problem in the First World War with the British intelligence services, and the problem with the CIA and other intelligence services had during the Cold War was that they were worried that they'd be swamped by so many sightings that they wouldn't be able to know, if it was an enemy aircraft or missile coming in or whether it was a UFO. So in a way, the authorities did need to kind of be able to categorize and code these cases so that they could then determine which were true or not. And I think in a way that causes such authorities to want to ridicule and suppress these sightings. So that it would have to be a really good sighting for anyone to come forward and report it. So it's quite. So I think, in a way, for the CIA to say they were responsible, obviously, they couldn't have created all these sightings, you know, throughout the world, and it is a worldwide phenomenon and not just, you know, restricted to North America. So, in a way, I think most governments were quite, you know, perplexed and puzzled by the subject. And I suppose even now, governments are sort of you know, releasing files online and everything, but obviously people aren't satisfied with that because they say, you know, a lot of the really top secret stuff is being, you know, hidden away still.
Right. Well, a lot of the stuff that's been released from all the foreign governments is. Some of the stuff is redacted, so you can't read what the juicy parts would have been. Or, more importantly, it's innocuous crap that really doesn't have any bearings. There's no real definitive answer either way what they decided that it was that they encountered. Let's go to the phones. East of the Rockies, Jonathan in Mississippi. You're on Coast to Coast AM with Nigel Watson and Dave Schrader. How can we help you this evening?
Yes, I would like to ask, he referred to the beginning of the talk about the Red Baron shooting down the aircraft. I was going to ask, do you know if he was flying a solo mission or if his squadron was there to witness him shooting the aircraft down, and if they found any wreckage of the aircraft?
Right. Apparently he was flying with a squadron, and it was... the actual dogfight between the Red Baron and this alleged UFO was supposed to be witnessed by a German Air Force ace called Peter Wolfsrich, but apparently no such pilot seems to have actually been in the German Air Force, so some people think it was a made-up character. And also... I don't think anyone actually did find any wreckage or find anything else linked to the crashed, allegedly crashed object. But obviously, in a time of warfare, perhaps you know, pinning down actual location of things like that would have been, even if it had occurred, would have been very difficult. And probably behind enemy lines as well.
Right, yeah, you wouldn't want to put down and go on foot chase or put yourself in position to possibly be captured after shooting something down like that.
Yeah, even if it was something, you know, if it had actually occurred, you know, which is another area, but if it had occurred, you know, like you say, it would have been very difficult to land anyway, and then with a problem of knowing if there was any enemy action going on there as well. Yeah, it's it wouldn't have been very viable.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Yeah. David from Anchorage, Alaska. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hi, Nigel. Hi, hi, David.
Hi.
Hello.
There was. I was wondering if you'd heard this. This is actually true. It's a strange piece of history, but. But John Worrell Keeley was part of the ministry, which is eventually turned into WISP ministry, and he was dealing with anti-gravity back in the 19th century, the late part of the 19th century. And he had built several of these airships, as you call them, for the super rich of the world. And they were the ones that sort of look like Zeppelins, but they're not really shaped like Zeppelins. They're more like tubes. And give credence to this, as human beings have been making anti-gravity craft, they have just been more advanced than the regular aircraft. The ones back in World War One, if I don't think that you mentioned this, but they only traveled several hundred miles an hour. That was the fastest they ever did. And they were actually clocked going over from town to town in England at several hundred miles an hour, which was crazy fast when you're talking about biplanes that only traveled maybe 60 miles an hour. and trains that traveled, you know, tens of miles an hour, and that's it. So it was, at the time, it was thought to be super advanced, but hundreds of miles an hour is not what an alien would be traveling at on the planet Earth after coming from another star system. So, anyway, I was wondering if you'd ever heard of this.
To be honest, no, I've not heard of that. But I think if you go back to that period, there were lots of different designs and patents for all sorts of incredible-looking craft, and some of them do obviously look like almost like flying saucers or UFO-type craft that have been seen in the skies, you know, in the last few years. And also,
I should add to that that I do believe that, of course, I know from the Ministry that there are beings from other planets, people from other planets, if you will. They're not human beings, people from other planets that are visiting Earth and have very high levels of technology. But these very high levels of technology are much more advanced than, you know, the
that
we had in the Star Wars shows, you know, those type of things. Are...
Thank you, David. We appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, I
mean, when you're looking at cases like this, where they're, you know, obviously, if these craft were flying that much faster, breakneck speeds, things that we were unable to attain at the time, which is similar to what the stories were during World War II. Were there any correlations with the designs of the craft, do you know, that between World War I and World War II that seemed to align with, you know, similar mentions?
I suppose the most common one is, you know, fast-moving lights or elusive lights or lights that seem to have intelligent properties, either because they're kind of like remote control, but they seem to respond, you know, like that, the pilot's encounter over London, when it was shot at, it responded by flying away. And so in a way, there's these... what you might call intelligent light phenomenon. But I've not really tried to correlate anything with World War II things in a rigorous fashion. But I think if you look at the works of, say, John Keel or Jacques Vallée, they've looked at this aspect of cultural tracking that we always see, you know, UFOs or aliens or whatever they might be that we're controlling UFOs, manipulate the way we see things so that their craft are always one step of our modern technology, so that we're able to perceive them in terms that we can understand. So in a way, their theories were that, you know, they could be craft from, you know, other dimensions that are sort of just manipulating our perceptions, which is quite an interesting take on this phenomenon, because it goes away from just them being, you know, nuts and bolts aliens, that they could be projections of things. So, you know, that theories about these craft can be quite complex, really, you know, and go beyond just balloons and lights in the sky.
Nigel Watson, our guest. When we return, we'll continue to take your calls. And I'm curious, was there reports of interference from these craft with weapons or craft in the area, direct areas? So we'll find out about that and so much more right here on the best in overnight talk radio. You're listening to Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Nigel Watson, my guest. Nigel, I'm curious, during World War I, with these UFO sightings, was there ever reported interference of the technology, maybe disarming the weapons, anything like that that, you know, you could share with us?
No, I don't think there was any cases like that, really. The news we get of to encounter where somebody shot at the craft, actually, in the middle of a British Phantom airship scare in 1909, there were one or two really well-recorded stories of close encounters. One in particular involved a Mr. Lethbridge, who was a Punch and Judy man, one evening he was returning home over Caerphilly Mountain, and he saw some men standing at the top of a hill who were talking loudly to each other, and they were wearing heavy fur coats, and they were next to this long tube-shaped object that was on the ground. And they, as soon as the men saw him, they sort of jumped into a carriage that was suspended from this long cigar-shaped tube, and they quickly rose into the air. The craft sort of went off in a zigzag fashion, and then it shined two lights from it, and then it went high off into the sky and went off towards Cardiff. And he said he thought that there were some wheels on the bottom of this little carriage, and there was like a fan whirring away at the back of it that sounded like a motor car. What's interesting about that is the next day he went back to the location with some reporters, and they found a 54 feet long gouge in the ground. There's lots of trampled grass. There's lots of news clippings scattered all over the place about aircraft and warfare, and odd bits of paper and a few bits of litter, really. So in a way, it did leave a bit of quite substantial evidence, really, there that something had taken off from that location. And also, you know, with him saying that the occupants sort of spoke in a foreign language, which he thought was German, you know, obviously related it to the current scare that was going on. And also, you know, to back up his stock, some workers in Cardiff also saw a cigar-shaped boat in the sky travelling at high speed with two lights on it. Not long after Lethbridge's encounter. But there again, some of the explanations, one was that a local aeronaut said that he sewed several 25 feet long model airships. He thought that somebody had been sailing one of them at the time, but that still doesn't explain the sighting of the men getting into the carriage or the ground traces, really. And that's a bit like I said before, there's always somebody comes along, you know, with a sort of plausible sounding explanation. And there's related to that is the fact that somebody else, a Dr. Boyd, said that he'd spent 8 years perfecting an airship that was 120 feet long, and that it could travel 1,000 miles non-stop, and he said that it had two wings and a cabin that could carry three people. And he'd used that on several occasions, so he self-implicated that his craft was responsible for sightings in Ireland and by Lethbridge. But, you know, that goes back to an earlier caller's talk about all these, you know, the people creating secret inventions, really, that seem to have far superior technology and abilities and the stuff that was, you know, publicly known about.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we've got callers on the international line, wildcard line, and more. We'll take your calls next here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Nigel Watson and your phone calls. Let's go to the international caller line. Taryn in Canada, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. It's an honor. Thanks for taking my call. I've been trying to call in for the past 6 years, and I just know seemed to fluke it off, but I just had a question about do these UFO things, do they steal resources? The reason why I'm asking is because I think in 2002, 13, 14 years ago, about springtime, about this time, I was eating dinner, leaning up against the rail on the front doorstep of my mom's, and it was a really nice night, no clouds whatsoever, and I was just mistaking this because sometimes these satellites come a little bit too close for comfort there, and I was just kind of waving it off, and we got oil fields out here, and it actually wasn't even dark out either, and I was just enjoying the sky, the night sky when it was getting dark out, and I noticed that it was getting bigger, and it was actually getting bigger and brighter, and I was looking up, and as I was eating my dinner, I was overwhelmed in what I seen. I can't even go into detail because it was so overwhelming. I've been trying to see if I can get a psychic to take me back to that day so I can get into detail in what I seen. And
yeah, you might want to look into doing like a hypnotherapy or regression on that. Taryn, thank you very much for calling. How about that with the claims that you've investigated over the years, from abduction claims, UFO claims, do they seem to be taking any of our resources? Is there, you know, any pure proof or fact that that might be what's going on?
Well, that's something that could be going on. A lot of sightings have been seen near lakes where they've been seen to be taking on water, and I think there's obviously been a lot of sightings near nuclear power stations and power generating plants, and obviously there's been a lot of sightings near power lines and UFOs causing power blackouts, which sort of implies that there might be either their propulsion systems are knocking out these systems, although, could be draining power from the systems. But it's quite interesting because quite a lot of phantom aircraft were seen in Canada during the First World War as well. And it's quite also interesting that, I was saying there were just lights from the sky and planets and those sorts of explanations. But often people just see a light in the sky, which triggers off memories, the caller said, of something that, something else might have happened, but we don't know quite what. So, people do go to seek out hypnotic regression or meditate on these things to find out what might have happened. So sometimes these are what I sort of call a sort of trigger event, and often it might be just an odd light in the sky might alert people to look out for other things, and then we go on to have other encounters and perhaps discover that, they might have had some abduction in the past. And it can also leave to lifestyle changes as well. People can become more artistic or inclined to do things that we've put off doing, or become vegetarians or have a healthier lifestyle, or we just get a different perspective on life that, we're not, we're just part of a larger galaxy or universe of beings. So I think, even if it's a simple light in the sky, it can trigger quite deep feelings in people. Whatever it is that's triggering it, whatever the origin of it, it can have quite profound changes on people. And also, it's like with the sightings before the First World War, even if there's absolutely nothing alien or anything to them, they did cause... We did help Winston Churchill to create defences against German zeppelins, and also it brought about the rapid introduction of a British Aerial Navigation Act, which introduced exclusion zones for aircraft and introduced laws making aviators from other countries to go through customs, and brought in other legislation that... set the boundaries for aerial flights, really. So UFO sightings can have quite a lot of implications and effects on real life.
All right, let's grab wildcard line one, JT in San Jose, California. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
Doing great. Thank you for listening and calling in. What's your question this evening?
Well, I actually tuned in a little bit late. I tuned in at 1, you know, PST time. But anyways, my question was about the bell. Did Hitler create that actual bell, and was it successful with, you know, time travel?
All right. Well, that, I think the old area of sort of Nazi UFOs is quite fascinating, really, because Hitler was obviously impressed by new technology and bigger is better, which there again is a reflection of, you know, the German Zeppelins were the biggest and best aerial craft. And I think Hitler continued in that vein by creating, you know, he had huge super tanks built, and he had pumped billions of Deutschmarks or whatever it was to create V2 terror weapons. But whether the bell type UFO thing was created by the Nazis is a sort of quite a grey area, really. I think it's something people have introduced more in more recent years than something at the time. I think certain government agencies in America actually tried seeking out different aircraft inventors shortly after Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947. Because the U.S. wanted to find out if the Russians had captured any German scientists that have carried on, you know, with their experiments in, you know, delta-winged aircraft and craft that look very much like UFO craft today. But a lot of their research that I've seen just sort of came to a dead end, really. But it does make you wonder whether anything like that was created and then applied to technology afterwards by either, you know, the Soviet Union or the United States.
Thank you, JT. We appreciate that. East of the Rockies, Stacy in Mississippi. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, thank you very much. Hi, Nigel.
Hi.
I was wondering if you had heard, I'd read years ago an obscured statement on General MacArthur in the Pacific Theater, where against the congressional investigation, where he actually started his own UFO investigation on sightings in the Sea of Japan and somewhere in the South Pacific. And also, as far as the anti-grav goes, spaceships, I've seen paintings from the Renaissance where there are UFOs in the background of the paintings themselves in the 1500s. And, you know, the Hall of Records state that, you know, this is a backwater planet on the edge of the galaxy, and yeah, we've been visited thousands and thousands of times. But the main question, I guess, would be General Mack, if he, I'm just not sure where I read that or if it was true or not.
All right. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah. I think in terms of Foo Fighters, although, you know, the best known accounts are over Europe, I think in the Pacific Theater of War, there are also sightings. But I don't know much detail about that, but I know that it was a sort of worldwide phenomenon, just like UFOs are today. I think it's like with the UFOs of the First World War, really. You assume, you know, that, you know, most of the cases are from Britain or Europe. But I think if people start looking in their own archives and start finding material virtually anywhere in the world, really, if you can find the newspaper archives, like in the First World War, people are turning up more and more new cases. As apparently there was quite a lot of sightings in Australia during the First World War, Canada, USA, Norway. So I think as time goes by and a lot of these archives are coming online, we begin to find, you know, that there's far more information out there. And it's also interesting that a lot of medieval paintings do depict all sorts of strange UFO-like objects. I think what happens, though, is sort of art experts tend to regard them as symbolic of things rather than literally craft. But a lot of these painters have some really intriguing images that look just like flying saucers beaming lights down, or craft with occupants inside them. So,
right, and what's really intriguing about it is the fact, too, that considering the time, most of those pieces of art were commissioned by the church, and they were very specific. There are receipts written that show exactly all the way down to the pigment that they used, what was to be created, what was to be put in there. That's why a lot of the old Renaissance art, you don't see trees or background stuff unless it had something important to do with the story. They were very concise and precise with what they wanted. So the artists didn't have a lot of leeway to do their versions. And at the time, artists were very representative of the time. So they had a certain way an angel or the moon or the sun were represented. Yeah. So a lot of these craft don't seem to fit into that parameters. So there's definitely something to look into with the artwork from the Renaissance and knowing how few pieces still exist. And of those pieces, how strange it is that so many of them have these kind of bizarre craft.
Yeah, I think if you look even back to sort of ancient times, there's quite a lot of symbols that look like, you know, saucers and UFOs and things. But a lot of the images are quite symbolic. Whereas if you look at Renaissance paintings, they're very realistic representations of anatomy and landscape, and less symbolic.
Right, exactly. Nigel Watson, thank you so much for being our guest this evening. Also, special thanks to our guest, Bill Burns. I want to thank Nathan and Gina back in the home office, Tim, my engineer here, Lisa Lyon, George, Nori, and of course, the master, Art Bell. Thank you very much for opening up what is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Check me out at darknessradio.com, and I'll be back with you sometime in April. Have a great night. Be nice to one another.